From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the dead in the desert, how the harsh landscape of South Texas is littered with the remains of migrants and the efforts to save lives and honor the dead. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Brooks County is just under 1,000 square miles. It's almost entirely dry, barren, and rugged. Some call it the Texas Death Valley, but it's not a valley, but there certainly is death in this South Texas county. Brooks County is the big barrier for people who are in the country illegally and who are trying to get into the U.S. interior and get into the big cities where they can melt into the population. Migrants from Mexico and Central America are so desperate to come to the United States and work that they are willing to risk death to do it, and they are well aware of those risks. There are rescue efforts by the Border Patrol, the Brooks County Sheriff's Department, and volunteers who are also operating at great risk and expense, but certainly that is not enough.
Brooks County 911. Hello?
From the sweltering heat of the South Texas desert comes a call for help.
Hola. ¿Me puedo ayudar?
It's common for the Brooks County Sheriff's Department to receive 911 calls from migrants who are lost in the harsh terrain and are near death.
Como no hablé, Sonia, una muchacha me contestó. Después me pasó para otro.
This time, a group of migrants from El Salvador, who have been beaten down by the heat, dehydration, and exhaustion, are giving up on their American immigration dream. They want the Border Patrol to come and get them.
Somos muchachos que hablamos hace ratito sobre la inmigración.
But where are they in all that scrub brush acreage? They don't know.
No mira la dirección. No.
They look for clues, and the 911 operator tells them that help is coming, but it's going to be a while. As the call ends, the woman expresses how hopeless she is and that she expects to die there. Brooks County is about 70 miles north of the Mexican border. This is where the Border Patrol strategically stationed a checkpoint on Highway 281 at the town of Falfurrias. For migrants looking to enter into the interior of the U.S., they know that they must avoid that checkpoint to evade capture. So off they go, on foot, into the thorn brush desert.
It could be as far south as 50 miles away, or it could be real close to the checkpoint. And this heat and this weather, it gets pretty serious.
Eddie Canales is with the South Texas Human Rights Center.
They're crossing through thick brush, mesquite, cactus, and then underneath is sand. Walking through sand is difficult.
It's so difficult that many die. In 2019, over 30 human remains were discovered in Brooks County alone. That number is down from previous years. Over the last 10 years, though, it's estimated that 700 people died crossing Brooks County. Most of those people never had their human remains recovered. Their bodies are left where their coyote guides left them because they couldn't keep up.
King Ranch, a lot of recovery here. These three ranches have the main areas where bodies are recovered and skeletal remains.
In the summer, the temperature is routinely over 100 degrees, and it's during the summer that Brooks County sees the most migrants. Canales' mission is to help the people who make that journey come out of the desert alive.
We've got over 170 water stations. You're trying to get water in between, water before and water afterwards. We'll never have enough. I don't want it too far off. But,
on this day, I'm with Canales as he builds a few more stations.
Help me build your water station.
And he checks on others to see if they need to be restocked with water jugs.
How's it look?
Each water station consists of a big blue plastic barrel with the word agua painted on the side. Inside, there are gallons of jugs of water that are sitting on top of a crate.
The crate, so it makes it easier for people to pick up the water.
Canales says he rarely sees any of his water stations vandalized. More often, he has seen that people in the community actually add jugs of fresh water to the stations.
When you see people dropping a case of water into your water station, there is good faith.
On top of the water stations, there is a tall pole with a white flag that's whipped back and forth in the hot desert wind. And on the lid of each of the barrels, there are the GPS coordinates for that location. So if a group of migrants need to be rescued, they can call authorities and tell them exactly where they are, and the Border Patrol can pull them out of the desert while they are still alive. On a bright winter's day, two graves are being dug at the Sacred Heart Cemetery in Falfurrias. This is a dig to retrieve bodies of unidentified migrants who died in the Brooks County desert.
So these are people that probably died on somebody's private ranch in Brooks County.
Kate Spradley is a forensic anthropologist at Texas State University and director of Operation ID, which seeks to document and identify the migrant remains that are found in South Texas and then return those remains to their families.
They're in the Texas desert walking to try to get around the checkpoint, and it's very easy to get disoriented. There's nothing to orient you north, so you can just walk around in the same mile, you know, for days, not knowing which way north is. And it, when you get dehydrated or you're injured and you get separated from your group, you just...
Some of those human remains are discovered and end up buried here at Sacred Heart Cemetery. But buried without ceremony, it's more accurate to say that these human remains were disposed of by throwing them without much care into holes in the ground. The migrant bodies are sometimes in garbage bags, cardboard boxes, or milk crates, sometimes two, three, or four individuals to a hole.
A local informant came to us in January and told us that she could not buy the plot next to her father because there might be unidentified people buried there.
Operation ID usually works like that. There are few records of unidentified migrant burials. South Texas counties are overwhelmed and underfunded for this task. So when Spradley gets a tip that there might be some migrants buried in a spot, they go check it out. But she says the people who oversee the Sacred Heart Cemetery aren't much help.
There's been maybe 130 that have been exhumed from this cemetery. There could be 50 more, there could be 100 more, just in this cemetery alone. This is the cemetery where the migrants are buried. We're in Brooks County, this is the county cemetery, so this is where they go.
This is where almost everyone in Brooks County gets buried. It's a focal point of the community. Most of the gravestones are festooned with decorations to mark the passing holidays. There's an active Facebook page for the cemetery with lots of festive graveside photos. The placement of the burial plots also tells the history of local racial segregation, and community members are a little uneasy seeing how outsiders are digging up unidentified migrants right in the middle of Sacred Heart.
Actually, I just came around to just pass by my parents and I saw all of this.
San Juanita Olivares is a Falfurrias native and was curious about the activity in the cemetery.
I'm glad they're finding these bodies. Mainly because, especially the unidentified ones, they, you know, if I had a son or daughter and was missing, I'd want to know. And the fact that they're being, that after this part, they hopefully will be identified.
It's taken a full day of digging, and the team of forensic anthropology students who have been shoveling dirt, hauling it away in wheelbarrows, and then using hand spades and brushes have uncovered evidence of other possible burials at this site. But mainly they have exposed one central migrant burial. It's an individual in a blue cremation bag.
Like away and under, yeah.
The team is going to carefully hoist the stiffened remains out of the grave and place it into a white plastic disaster body bag. And now the real work begins that might lead to matching a name to that body.
And then we'll submit a DNA sample to the federal DNA database called CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System. We'll put all of the information we have about this person into NAMIS, which is the National and Unidentified Missing Persons System. And NAMIS is nice because we upload that information. We upload photos of any personal effects, clothing, sometimes stuffed animals, luchador masks. There's all kinds of stuff that people carry with them that they're buried with.
Anyone can search the NAMIS website. Families frequently go online looking for answers about what happened to their missing loved ones.
We've identified 35 people so far, and we have a few more identifications pending. And You know, it's great to make an identification, but for that family member, we have to realize that they actually have, it's the first time they have to process the death. You know, it's not the outcome that they had hoped for. But they get answers to questions, and I think that helps them quite a bit. They don't have to not know anymore.
The Brooks County Sheriff's Department says that for every body of an unidentified migrant that is recovered, there are at least five more out in the desert that were never recovered. Their remains were set upon by the environments and the elements, and they basically became part of the landscape, which is why many people look at South Texas and say the whole area is now one big graveyard. Walking into the Operation ID storage area at Texas State University, and it's easy to be overwhelmed. There were over 260 brown, sturdy cardboard boxes stacked neatly in rows. In each one are the remains of a migrant recovered from South Texas. They are labeled with a number, but not a name, which is why they are here. These are the nameless.
There's a lot of skeletons in here.
Kate Spradley is a forensic anthropologist at Texas State University and director of Operation ID.
I want them to all be identified and go back to their loved ones.
Spradley's team of faculty and college students literally unearthed these remains in the border area, and she says this isn't half of the number of migrants who have died in South Texas.
I think this is an extremely low percentage, and I don't know the percentage because we don't have an accurate number of how many people have died. Everything is an underestimation. Since 2009, almost 900 people have died in Brooks County alone. So this is just a small number, but still overwhelming.
Spradley pulls a box from the shelf and opens it. Inside, there's a skull and bones. In brown paper bags, there are the personal items.
This person had a stuffed lion, a small, looks like a child's toy, and a luchador mask as well.
Operation ID does post photographs of these personal items on the NAMIS website, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, operated by the University of North Texas Center for Human Identification. And that's how Zyra Gonzalez found out what happened to her brother Christian.
Even after I found the case with the NAMIS situation, it's like a part of me still hoped that it wasn't my brother.
I met Zyra at a coffee shop in Palestine in East Texas. This is where she and her older brother, Christian, grew up living the all-American dream, except they were in the country illegally, brought here by their parents from Mexico.
My brother was 7, 8 years old, and I was just 3. And, I mean, we have a younger brother as well that was 1. We were brought here to Palestine, and we lived here pretty much all our lives. To school here, brother graduated in 2007, played sports, soccer, cross country, graduated with honors.
Christian was the kind of guy that people were naturally drawn to. He was an outgoing trickster who volunteered at his church. His friends called him Buddha.
He did like stuff like ranches, and people paid him cash because that's pretty much all he could do since he didn't have a way of actually having an actual physical job.
One day, there was an accident with a pellet gun, and he pleaded guilty to aggravated assault. That caught the attention of immigration enforcement, and Christian was deported to Mexico. Christian did not fit in well there. Also, once he arrived, his uncle was kidnapped by a cartel, and he was never seen again.
He got deported in May of 2012, and by August, he already wanted to come home that same year.
Christian's father made arrangements for him to come back to Palestine through a coyote.
He got a bus from Monterrey to the border through Reynosa. He stayed there for a few days, and then they did a whole day walk from Reynosa to McAllen. And stayed in McAllen for a few days. And then from there, they continued to walk. His last place where he was at was in Farfurias, Texas, not far away from the last checkpoint. That was the last time we've heard from him.
Christian was in the desert, and he was dehydrated and exhausted. The coyote called Christian's father and said he needed to motivate his son to keep walking or else he was going to be left behind. On the phone, Christian sounded disoriented.
My dad actually talked to my brother, and he just told him, "I'm tired, I can't do this anymore." My dad got back on the phone with the the guy that was crossing him over and told him, okay, well, put him on the side of the road where somebody can see him. Immigration, a person, it don't matter. As long as somebody sees him. But he didn't do that. He just left him in the middle of the desert.
This experience has taken a toll on the Gonzalez family. Zaira says her parents haven't recovered. She's traveled to Brooks County and was shown exactly where her brother died. She has those GPS coordinates tattooed on her forearm. Operation ID had recovered Christian's remains. His DNA was entered into the database. Photos of his belongings were put on NamUs, and years later, hunting online, Zaira found him. Eventually, his remains were brought to Palestine, and he was given a funeral and buried with a headstone. At the gravesite, there's a photograph of Christian in his cross-country uniform. There's a small soccer ball on top of the grave, a statue of Buddha, and a bottle of water. The question that comes up from this tragic situation in Brooks County, is it right for the United States to have a public policy that takes so many lives? Border protection is important, but there are steps that can be taken to have a secure southern border without allowing for so many people to die of heat stroke and dehydration in order to avoid it. And also, we need to note that these are national public policies that have been in place for over 30 years. Presidents from both parties have embraced and continue to use death in the desert as a deterrent to illegal immigration. But under President Donald Trump, overall, using death, imprisonment, and family separation as border security policy and as a political opportunity has been taken to a new level. I spoke with New York Times journalist Julie Hirschfield Davis about that. She is the co-author of the book, Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration.
No, we do not have open borders. We have, as are all borders in this day and age, we have a border that is constantly being crossed for reasons of commerce and immigration and all sorts of other things that is patrolled by American authorities. And yes, if migrants arrive at the border and they say that they're fearing for their lives and they can't go back to where they are from, there is a process by which they are allowed to come in and make that claim. And in Trump's mind, he considers that to be open borders. But in reality, that is just our immigration system that, you know, in compliance with American laws and also international laws, allows people to claim asylum if they are fearing violence or persecution if they go home.
So we don't have open borders. We have a very robust Border Patrol agency and a lot of money that's spent, billions and billions of dollars, to patrol our borders and keep them safe and secure. And then we also don't have an immigration crisis where we have hordes of horrible people streaming across the borders trying to undermine law and order in the United States. So then what we actually have is theater, right?
Right. I mean, I would also say that we do have a system that, you know, has a lot of problems in terms of the way that immigrants are processed in our system, right? There's a huge backlog of asylum seekers. There's a huge wait to get a green card. There are lots of bottlenecks in the system that I think you could argue, and many Republicans and Democrats would argue, are impractical and ultimately not sustainable and should be addressed.
Right, but that's not what Trump is promoting. He's promoting not fixing the immigration system, but stopping the immigration system.
Correct. But I think it would be naive and not productive to say that there's nothing wrong with the immigration system, because there are plenty of ways in which we do have a dysfunctional system that does need updating. And frankly, I think that one of the side effects of all of his rhetoric and all of his misrepresentation of this issue is that we are much further away from any real consensus on how to address those very real problems than we were before he became president.
You write that the president's overarching goal was to make the experience of crossing the border into the United States as terrifying and as perilous as possible. What do you mean?
Well, we all know and have heard how obsessed he is with the idea of the border wall. And that was, I think, as much a practical idea as it was a symbol for him of, I'm going to be tough. I'm going to sort of put up this barrier and people are not allowed in. I don't want people in. It was a rhetorical device as much as it was a policy proposal. But what became clear once he became president was, to the people around him who were there to sort of implement his vision, was that it wasn't really enough for him to actually build this barrier. What he really wanted was a formidable, kind of menacing, scary thing that was going to deter people, he thought, from even trying to cross. He wanted it to be, you know, as threatening as possible, as painful as possible. He talked about putting spikes on the top of the wall, having it potentially be electrified. He wanted it to be done in flat back, flat black paint, both because he thought it was beautiful, but also because it would get hot in the sun and it could burn people. He talked at one point about digging a trench that could be filled with water and potentially having alligators in it or snakes in it, something that would either be so bad that people would never bother to approach it, or that if they did, would hurt them very badly. So this was all, these were all measures that he kind of grasped for when he thought about how he could control the flow of people coming into the country. And, you know, he didn't actually implement most of them.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm speaking with Julie Hirschfield Davis, co-author of the book Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. We have the Rio Grande, at least in Texas we do. That's basically a moat. It's fast-moving water. People drown in the Rio Grande all the time trying to cross. It does have alligators in it. I've seen them. Why did he think we needed to have a moat in addition to that? Did he not know that there was a grant? There was a river there?
I don't think so. I mean, of course, he knows that the Rio Grande exists. This is not a president who focuses on any kind of detail. He had not been to the border very often, although he did visit it a few times. When he would be told by aides, and they would say this often, that there were plenty of natural features at the border that were, you know, big enough deterrents to people that would prevent people from crossing, even if they wanted to. He would take that in, but he, and this goes back to the idea that this is less a practical idea for him than it is a messaging thing. He was fixated on this notion of one long wall, one long barrier that was going to be impossible to cross. And nothing that his staff would say to him, whether it was about, well, there's already a very dangerous river there, or, well, we can't really build on some of this property in Texas and California because people own that property, really mattered to him. He would say, well, just take the land and we'll they can sue us, you know? He was not really focused on, he has not been focused on any of the practical limitations here.
He also said that U.S. should shoot the people trying to cross the river, right?
Trying to cross the border, yes. Last summer, when the caravan sort of started up again, and he started wanting to talk about it because it was getting close to the midterm congressional elections, and he found that to be a useful theme. He talked about if some of the migrants at the border, I think there was a day or a few days where there was some rock throwing at the border. He said if people were throwing rocks at American troops or Border Patrol, that they should consider that a rifle, which was his way of saying basically they should shoot them. If they get rocks thrown at them, that they should shoot migrants. And his staff very quickly, having seen him on Fox News saying this, spun into action, sent him and the White House the rules of engagement at the border, which say that you can't use lethal force unless you're threatened in a lethal way. So they got him to publicly walk back that comment. But in a meeting a few days later, when they were discussing, you know, what could be done, he said, well, I understand. You've told me we can't shoot them to kill. But what if we just shot them in the legs? Because that would slow people down. And he thought that would.
It's been quoted that Stephen Miller, who is the, I guess, the Svengali in the White House on immigration. What do you call Stephen Miller?
I would say Svengali is not a bad word. I mean, he's a mind meld with Trump on this issue. He's, I would say, the most influential person in that White House when it comes to immigration.
And he was quoted saying that regardless of the optics, when the focus is on the border, on immigration, even if it's children in cages and crying, Trump is winning. What does that mean?
I think that he feels that this is an issue where Trump is at his most powerful. That, you know, as we discussed before, this is the issue that propelled him to victory in the Republican primary, victory as president, and that it is something that plays to his best strengths. And whenever they're talking about immigration, Trump is talking about his brand and is getting a message to the public that accrues to his advantage. And I just think that that's why we see that whenever Trump is under pressure on any issue, choose your issue, or getting close to an election, this is where he goes, because he thinks that this is such a powerful theme that really riles up his base and reminds people why they supported Donald Trump in the first place.
So it was a year ago when Donald Trump sent troops to the border. This was right as we were getting ready for the congressional elections, the midterm elections. Trump went ahead and he ordered the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, to go to the border and deploy those troops. When Jim Mattis was asked about that, is this a stunt? He said, we don't do stunts. Was this a stunt?
I would say this was a stunt, yes. There was no military reason that troops were needed at the border any more than they ever had been in the past. Now, there had been precedent for sending the National Guard. George W. Bush did it at one point. Barack Obama did it at one point, to help assist with border operations at the border. And that had been done in the past when the migration flow had built up, and they felt like that was needed. To be fair, in both of those cases, I think you could argue that part of the reason they did it was because of optics, because there was a real uptick in the number of people who were coming, and they wanted to make it clear that we are going to be enforcing our border, and if it takes some military personnel to back up our border agents while doing that, that's what we're going to do. But this was something else again. I mean, this was the president really wanting to do something because he felt that he couldn't do anything else to really be more aggressive at the border. And even when we interviewed President Trump for this book in the Oval Office in this past spring, he lamented to us how, you know, we have this great military, we could have 100,000 people, you know, on the border, 100,000 military troops on the border, and they could never do anything. They just couldn't do anything. And you could tell it really eats at him that it is not possible to have the military essentially take action against people coming across the border to hold them back.
But it's significant that the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, would use the military as a political stunt in the weeks ahead of the midterm elections to influence that outcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's striking. And
shouldn't we be thinking about that going into his reelection?
I do think that nobody should be surprised if this idea of sending the military to the border or somehow doing some very high profile enforcement action, either at the border or in the interior, resurfaces as the election draws nearer. I do think that this is something that he wants to be top of mind for voters.
Julie Hirschfield Davis is the co-author of the book Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.